Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Today, I continue my conversation with recent Alaska Writer Laureate Frank Sose. This episode, Working with Others.
We were colleagues that we could count on with one another. If we said we were going to do something, it would be done, and it would be done as well as we could do it. And that matters.
I hope you'll stick around. If there's a patron saint of this series, it's the French writer Montaigne. I routinely find comfort and inspiration in his penetrating examinations of what it means to be human. Montaigne was very much on my mind when I interviewed Frank Sose. Frank had just released a collection of essays, and I know he too had been informed by Montaigne, who was considered the father of the personal essay. While Montaigne was an aristocrat with a room in his chateau where he penned his observations, most writers today have to work to serve their muse, and for many that means teaching, Frank included. In fact, while he's now retired, for many years Frank taught at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he was good at it. Several of Alaska's literary lights had Frank as a professor. But Frank has also forged some lasting creative friendships with fellow UAF profs, perhaps most importantly with the painter and art historian Kes Woodward. Kes and Frank attended Davidson College together, and Frank's writing is deeply informed by the visual arts. They remain friends and have collaborated with each other on several projects. Frank is also married to the visual artist Margot Klass, and the two have exhibited together and created several books. In this episode with Frank, I talk with him about his education and collaborative experiences and projects. I began where I first met Frank, in the classroom. So you've been a teacher, still do a lot of teaching at workshops and conferences and whatnot. Does that inform your writing?
Sometimes, but usually not. In fact, often it's the opposite, that it the thinking, the creative energy it takes to teach, and especially the creative energy it takes to work closely with writers, it takes away. There's a finite amount, and it burns away. If when I was teaching full time, usually there would be one day a week when I would start the day and end the day by doing conferences at, for the grad students, usually an hour, and for the undergrads a half hour. And at the end of that day, I pretty much had no thought for any idea of my own because I'd spent the day helping other writers solve their problems. And to be an effective teacher, you do have to be a creative thinker. So I've gotten more writing done since I retired. And yeah, when I do something like a writer event, it takes something out of me. It doesn't put something in me very often. It just takes something out of me.
But you've played such an important role for so many well-known now Alaskan writers. There must be a certain satisfaction you get seeing that some
of... Oh, there is. And yeah. I think there are people, Sherry Simpson and the late Eva Salidas and Mary Oden, whose first book is, I hope, soon to come out. These writers write better than I can and better than I ever will. And that, too, is if you care about your teaching, you think, well, that's an element that matters, too, that I want them to be better than I could be because that's what I was there for. That was fun. It is fun when I can help folks. And I was happy. I just came back from the Kachemak Bay Writers Conference. There were four people there who'd been in these weekend workshops I'd taught at Anchorage a couple of winters ago, who were kind of pushing along and at varying degrees of luck. But I was happy that it just I'd given them an effective jump start. And that's not the same as the kind of intense work I did with grad students, but it's still satisfying.
Now, Ben, painting and the visual arts are important to you, Frank. How did that come about?
Well, before my sophomore year in college, I got a letter from our financial aid office asking me what I wanted my work-study job to be because it was understood I would have one. And my freshman year, I'd worked with elementary school kids in after school activities, which I enjoyed. But I thought, I'd looked at my curriculum, and even though we were at a liberal arts college, I saw that I wasn't going to get enough art or music to really satisfy what I thought was a big hole in my education. So I asked for those two areas, and I was extraordinarily lucky. If I'd gotten the music job, I would have just sat in the music lab giving out records and tapes all day. That would be the job. In the art department, I started my job coinciding with a new professor named Herb Jackson, who came right back to Davidson after getting his MFA degree. So he was a very young guy. He's probably maybe 4 years older than me, 5 years older than me. Young, full of ideas. The art department before Herb, I think, was a little bit of a backwater. But So I learned to look at art. I learned to look at art by looking over his shoulder. And before I was done, we were sponsoring the nation's biggest print and drawing contest. So I got to look over Herb's shoulder and a visiting judge. So we went through 2,500 works of art the first year and over 4,000 the next. And that second judge was Clement Greenberg. So I was learning from some people who really were significant thinkers and critics about art, and sucking up every word, but mostly learning to look, because Greenberg used to say, "Well, I'm just a big eyeball at this point. I've seen so many art." And he also said this. He said, "I know pretty much right off the bat, if I like something, then it's much harder to explain why he liked it." And that seems to me also to be true, that you teach your eye, and but you learn that too. I can remember when we were unpacking that first year, those 2,500 prints and drawings, and I would see something early on, and I would think, wow, boy, that is something. And then by the time we were done, that's not going to be in this show. That's not going to make it. So that's how I learned. And so in one way, I guess I learned backwards, because I was learning the most contemporary art there was. And the whole question of aesthetics is just, it's finally just, there was this old philosophy guy when I went to undergraduate school who would say, "Oh, aesthetics, taking up aesthetics is like wandering into a swamp. You never come out. You just wander around in there till you die." And that's pretty much true. I mean, there are no good answers to these questions, but I think you do want to keep them in play. And that's what I'm hoping I'm doing. I can remember sitting in my room and reading Jansen all by myself. I'm not sure that's the best. At that time, I think this is probably still true, there were no women artists in Jansen, in that art history book. But it was kind of the standard text. Just about
and a
every,
big one.
Yeah, big fat book, probably used in every art history survey in this country.
Yeah, I had it too. My guest today on Northern Soundings is Frank Soce. Frank's latest book is a collection of essays. His prose is versatile, and besides essays, he's penned award-winning fiction and, inspired by the arts of his wife Margot, produced some intriguing pieces he says he isn't sure what to call. Here's Frank on collaborations. I think, of course, you and Margot producing Double Moon, and then I know Kess and you have produced several works, Bamboo Fly Rod Suite with your essays and his paintings, and then Under Northern Lights. What does a collaborative process bring for you as a writer that writing solo doesn't?
Boy, you know, each one of those was a considerably different process. Let me say something about Bamboo Fly Rod Suite, because that was, I think, a remarkable act of good luck. what happened there was that I'd written these essays, and Kes had always said we should do something together. So he made some actually black and white only paintings to get one painting each to go with each essay. And we had this idea that we might be able to submit this to a small press of some kind that would come out in a very limited edition. And so we were shopping it around, and I saw a notice for what was called an eccentric book contest. And so I called this guy. He was down in Idaho, and he said, "Well, you're welcome. That's the kind of idea we've got in mind, but I've got to warn you that everybody else, other people are going to submit dummy books. They're going to submit facsimiles of the book they want to publish." So Kes and I agreed. We didn't know anything at all about making a book, but our friend Wanda Chin, who was then the curator of exhibits at the University Museum, did. And she said, "I can do that. I'll do that for you." And then she immediately just started issuing orders quick and fast to Kes and me. And in about a week, she had this remarkable book that the salient feature, people have seen Bamboo Fly Rod Suite, is there's what looks to be like a little piece of bamboo fly rod with a couple of leather ties and a fly affixed to one of the guides. Well, and the real Wanda version, that was a physical object and a piece of leader material, monofilament line, was tied to that fly, and it wrapped around the book, and the fly hooking into the guide is what closed the book. And so we sent it away, and it didn't win. So I called the guy again, and I said, "Well, we've got this book, and I'm wondering if you have any other ideas about where we could send it now." And he said, "Oh, you won't have any trouble at all with that. You won't. It'll be fine. You'll find a." He said, "That's very saleable."
After he'd rejected it.
Well, they ended up wanting something that was a lot more political, it turned out. That was the winning book. But so by and by, I won the Flannery O'Connor Award. And at that point, Barbara Rass, who's always been very interested in environmental writing, was one of the editors at the University of Georgia Press. And this book just seemed to fall off of the pile onto her lap. And already had this other connection, and so they took it. And first they took the essays, and then a few days later she called back and said, "Well, we've been thinking about it. We'd like the art too." And then a few days later she called back and said, "Well, the design people are so struck with the book Wanda designed, they can't imagine how to go forward without plagiarizing it. So do you think Wanda would be willing to make a design that was, more market friendly? We don't want any raw fish hooks in stores." And so Wanda did. And that's how we got where we got. So that was, in a way, that kind of collaboration. With Double Moon, Margot makes these pieces, and then I come and I look at them and I respond to them. And she has a certain amount of editorial control. She can veto things or ask for changes, and so there's some back and forth there. But in that book, the visual art came first, and my responses came second. And once again, Wanda designed the book, and my pieces tend to be another thing that I did collaboratively with Wanda was, she had me write some labels for an exhibit at the museum. And she sat me down and said, "Now listen, nobody will read a museum label that's over 250 words long." So Margot and I knew this stuff was going to be a show. In fact, there was a show in Fairbanks, and then we did a show in Homer for both this stuff and the Saints. So that was kind of my outside limit. And that's what made the pieces, my verbal pieces, the length they ended up being. They all had to be under 250 words, and they pretty much are. So,
well, and did that kind of restriction in some ways open possibilities, I often hear the haiku form, because of its strict limitation, actually in some way spawns a sort of a wider range of reactions or possibilities.
Well, interestingly, one of the things Kes and I end up talking about is a similar problem. He would say that one of the things that can get him to think about composition in different ways is to change the size of the canvas he's got available to him. And that's, to a certain extent, it's true. If you've got that's all the words you've got, you got to stay within that parameter. It does limit what you can do. And once again, since we're back almost to the essay again, there's no stop in an essay. I mean, it can go on forever and ever and ever. And sometimes the struggle is to figure out how to corral the thing, how to get under control, how to make sure the pieces aren't so disparate that the reader just goes, yeah, this is not an essay, it's just a mess. And there's always that risk. So I think that the hitting that limit helped. And that was, I think it caused me to write in different ways. And I've done similar problems since then that I've also been, they haven't had the strict length ceiling on them, but they've ended up being kind of small because I got comfortable doing that.
Yeah, and you managed to draw characterizations or discuss complications in such a concise form. It almost had the compression of a poem, and in many ways they were prose poems.
Sort of, yeah. You could call them that. We've never been quite sure what to call them. But yeah, and when you couple them with Margot's art, then that's the conversation. And that's something that Kes and I also ended up talking a lot about when we were editing Under Northern Lights. We did not want the art to be illustrations, and we did not want the text to be explanatory about the art. Each one of them was going to talk to the other one in a way that created some tension between the two, so that the reader would have to think, well, okay, now what's that piece of art got to do with this? So there's an essay in Under Northern Lights by Clarice Dickus, and it's about recreational kayaking. And we paired that with a painting called Running the Riffle, which shows a bunch of sourdoughs lining a boat upstream, you know, using a river for their work versus using it as a kind of a plaything. And that might be the best example of how we imagined that might work, that people would look at one and the other and they would feel this tension that was worth exploring.
Listening to Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. My guest is Frank Sose. His latest book of essays, Unpleasantries, Considerations of Difficult Questions, is published by University of Washington Press. I find one of the wonderful aspects about Fairbanks is that it attracts talented people, and in the ordinary course of events, you frequently run into them socially and form friendships. As you'll hear, through the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Frank continues to create and collaborate on projects with colleagues and friends. Well, now that we've talked about Kes here, I want to mention you both attended Davidson College.
Yeah.
And you two have been friends for so long. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. How did that work for you two?
Well, when we were undergraduates, we knew each other, but truly not well. Herb was Kes's teacher and my boss, and so we were in and out of the art department a lot, but Kes and Missy were a couple, and there were not many couples. They were the couple. Missy was the first co-ed to graduate from Davidson College, so they were sort of on their planet, and I was on my own strange planet. I think there is an aesthetic that Herb implanted in both of us that we do share. And we probably tend to agree more than we disagree about things, which is mostly good, but sometimes tension creates some interesting solutions. But we've been having lunch together for 25 years, and we don't run out of things to talk about. They can be, I think, to some listeners, kind of trivial, but sometimes things get fairly complex and deep, and sometimes they don't. But so having a running conversation that lasts that long is another positive thing, and there are ways that both of us, I think, use it to explore questions we're working on in our own work.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, I'm going to include Peggy Shoemaker, the poet, in the sense that it strikes me that there's a dynamic still at work in your lives. It's not like when you retired, each went your own ways and maybe exchanged Christmas cards. Mm. It seems like you all still wrestle with ideas, still spark new interest or ideas from each other. Would I be right on that?
There's to go back to Montaigne and to go back to the Stoics, there's I can think of no good reason to abruptly arrest your aesthetic or your spiritual or your intellectual life just because you don't have that same job anymore. The job mattered, and it mattered a lot that we were colleagues that we could count on with one another. If we said we were going to do something, it would be done, and it would be done as well as we could do it. And that matters. But in that way, you sort of learn who people are, and you learn who you can count on, and you learn some things about their thoughts. But our thoughts keep growing and changing, and so it seems to me pretty normal. I would hope it's pretty normal. I don't know. I don't know of other people in our situation. I mean, the hard thing about Alaska is that people bail because of, say, the weather. They just say, "Well, I can't do another winter up there," and I think that's sad and truly regrettable. We've lost some very good people the last few years who've retired and moved. And once there's that big of a physical difference, when they're living three states away, or hardly matters, any state away from Alaska, something's lost. And sometimes you can pick it back up when you see them, but the day-to-dayness that these interactions are based on is really lost.
Well, Frank Sos, the author of Unpleasantries, University of Washington Press, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Robert.
That's it for this week's show. My guest has been Frank Sos, former writer laureate for Alaska. His book, Unpleasantries, Considerations of Difficult Questions, was published last summer by University of Washington Press. If you want more information on Northern Soundings and my guest, go to northernsoundings.com. Music used by permission on Northern Soundings is from Julie Rafferty's CD, No Finer Place. Since we're a little shy on time this week, we'll go out with one of my favorite songs from the album, Two More Bottles of Wine. Until next time, I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Thanks for joining me.
Too much. It's coming round midnight with two more bottles of wine. Thank you.